If you're rocking to get up and it's not a rocking chair, it's time for the Joint Relief Institute. Fast relief, covered by Medicare. 708-888-0000, as in zero pain.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Paul Lisnick Behind the Curtain, our weekly look at theater in the city of Chicago. And today, well, you can see I'm sitting on the set of one of the most amazing shows that has played in this town in a long time at the Goodman Theater. It is called Holiday. It's actually an old show, but not anymore. So we're going to introduce you not only to this set, but two of the actors, leads in this show who are going to tell you what it's all about, because you do not want to miss it. It is playing only through March 8th at the Goodman. Oh, tickets going so fast, it's why it's been extended. But let me introduce you to my guests, and thank you for being with me.
Of course.
I think I'm going to start with the oldest sister,
sure.
Right? Because we're siblings in this show.
Hierarchy demands it.
Wow. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so, Bryce Gangle, you play Linda Seaton. You're the older sister here. This is your Goodman debut.
It is.
But I think you are so well-known from Chicago anyway, between the, I mean, I have to make a list, Rivendell and Remy Bumpo and Court Theater. And and you're also going to be in Ryan Murphy's American Love Story.
Yes, yes. I am in episode 5, which I think will come out next week. So
okay, this is the JFK Jr.
Yeah, JFK Jr., Carolyn Bessette love story.
Do you play another, like, does he end up with you?
No. I make my appearance at Hyannis. And with the Kennedy clan.
Okay.
So that's all I'll say.
Okay. I love that. You're not a mechanic on the plane or nothing like that.
No.
Okay.
No.
Also joining us is Wesley Taylor. Wesley, you and I go way back to Addams Family.
Long friends.
Pre-Broadway in Chicago, by the way, when
it started.
And then 2009, Nathan Lane, B.B. Newirth. I mean, also, it was unbelievable. So good. But you're known for a lot of other things. This, too, is your Goodman debut.
Yes.
But you were in SpongeBob. I saw you in Rock of Ages on Broadway as well. Fans of Only Murders in the Building, hello, nomination there for SAG. So congratulations on that one. That was such a great show.
Thank you.
And we'll talk about Meryl Streep later. And also Smash. I'm one of those people who, like, was nuts about Smash.
Oh. We can't go anywhere with him without some, you know, mid-30s woman screaming, being like, I love you in Smash!
It's and, so true.
And he says, Megan Hilty, you were in it. No,
yeah.
I'm kidding.
Yeah,
I love
true.
It. But also, you know what else I'm a fan of? Indoor Boys.
Oh, wow.
All seasons that you did deep dive with Alex Wise and stuff, and mutual friend Carolee Carmella, who was in that. So
who
we'll talk
my
later.
Mother
who was your mother, exactly. Yes. Okay, we're talking about Holiday, though. And this, let's find out what it's all about. Let's go to older sister. By the way, you play Ned. You're the younger brother with issues. We'll get to that. Bryce, what is the show all about? And kind of set it, if you will,
sure.
The fact that we're in this incredible living room.
Okay, so yes, this is our home. This is sort of the receiving room of the family home. Holiday is about this very well-to-do New York, you know, financial banking dynasty family. And
billionaire
family.
And in case you're wondering where it starts, we'll get a shot of the portrait behind me.
Yes.
That's great-great-grandpapa.
That's
right?
great-great-grandfather up there, Edward Seton the First.
Eddie One.
And the middle sister, Julia, kind of surprises the family with her brand new fiance. She's made a sort of spur-of-the-moment decision. Met this man in a whirlwind romance and brings him back, and wasn't entirely truthful about her familial situation. And it's then sort of about this young man meeting this family and meeting the various players of the family and of the, you know, New York business world, and him sort of in real time over the span of, you know, essentially 2 weeks is what the play takes place over, the New Year's holiday, and him sort of discovering himself and what he wants for not just the rest of his life, but his life right now. And in turn, you know, meets my character, Linda, and meets Ned, and meets our father and our cousins, and it all sort of devolves from there.
I've never pledged a fraternity, so why am I being hazed?
Never pledged a fraternity, Julia, how could you?
Are you at least Skull and Bones?
Or related to a building?
If you were teleported to 1956, would it take you a while to notice?
Have you ever said all lives matter?
When you have cocktails, do you consider the olive your meal?
Is your entire family made up of people with the same four names twisted into different arrangements, like Lego?
No to everything, except I think there was one yes, but I forget where.
Forgive them, Johnny. They're not socialized, so they get aggressive when there's a new person. They're not like this.
I hope they are.
You do?
Why?
You're fun.
Woo! Let this engagement terminate in marriage, Julia!
Wesley, your character, Ned, I mean, the show is very, very funny, but if I were to keep a scorecard of who has, I'm sorry, but who has the funniest lines in this show... You are a scream in this show, but you also have issues. So tell me about Ned's issues.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of a gift of a role. It really is, because it has everything. He is, unfortunately, plagued with some addiction issues and some alcoholism in a real way, as was his mother.
And that's a serious issue. That's I'm going to make light of that.
Very serious issue, but he makes plenty of light of it. That's how he copes. That's how he deals with it. But he's biting, he's droll, and he's going to make fun of everything. He's sort of been living under his father's thumb. In and out of rehab, you know, he's the youngest of the three kids, but he's in his late 20s now, still living with his dad, still living under this roof. While his sisters have made choices and have gotten out of the house and have branched out and found their lives, he has not. So it's sad, but you know, I think Richard Greenberg puts himself in the character, just as he did with Mason in Take Me Out. It's very much that.
So I just want to explain that because you said Richard Greenberg in Take Me Out was another one of his very famous plays. This is the last one, actually, he did before he passed. But take it back further, because you got to go back to Philip Barry. This play is actually originally written in the
20s. 1928, Philip Barry wrote this play right before the Great Depression. Mm-hmm. And, you know, over the last century, it's been produced all over on Broadway several times.
Here
at the Goodman.
Four times.
At the Goodman. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, after 100 years or so, the estate... Miranda Barry, granddaughter, and the whole family really wanted to keep the play relevant, and they commissioned Richard Greenberg to give us a modern, current-day translation of this play, an adaptation that feels now.
Yeah, I think the original rights ran out sort of like last year, so it became available to do that. But there's modern, I mean, we get references, I think I could just say this, but references to Lyft and Uber and those kind of things.
Yeah.
So
Uber
it's
Eats.
Brilliant,
yeah.
right?
Yes.
Sorry.
And it's just so, I really respect the Barry estate, because so often with these sort of playwrights of the modern American theater, or sort of classical American theater, I suppose I should say, they often really want to keep everything very pure, they don't want any changes, they don't want it to be adapted, they want to keep it kind of exactly as it was. And I have so respected the Barrys and Miranda, who we've had a lot of interaction with, that she really thought, you know, this play deserves to be refreshed and deserves to be seen in a new light by new audiences and new eyes in 2026. And what could that look like? And commissioning Richard, who's the perfect playwright, to take this play and sort of maintain what's special about it, maintain the architecture of it, maintain some of the language and the style of it, but then completely contemporize it, is so brilliant.
For instance, you know, Ned in the original 1928 Philip Barry play is a drunken bachelor, but he's not, you know, gay. He's not openly gay. I mean, he's probably gay. But it's not, because you don't speak about that in 1928. So now he's fully openly gay. A very welcome update.
It was also a movie, of course, Cary Grant and Katharine Hepburn. Did either of you watch it, or did you watch it in preparation for this?
I didn't watch it in preparation, no. Just I watched it just to watch it, you know, but this script is so its own thing. I was not worried at all about watching it and thinking like, oh gosh, is this going to influence me in a way that I don't want, or in a way where I feel like I'm not going to be able to get out of something Katharine Hepburn does. for me, impossible. This is just so completely its own thing. And that movie is such a, for, you know, me, like a relic of its time. It's beautiful and funny and charming, but to me is lacking a little something. You know, that's just my personal...
What's the modern day bite? But here's the thing. Greenberg, assuming this is in the script, I mean, the fact that you have Great Granddad up there, that is a statement by Greenberg to say, we're not taking it that far from the... In other words, we want you to remember from whence you come.
Yes, yes, yes. Correct.
Mm-hmm. And, and so we see that. I'm curious, Wesley, the chemistry between the three of you is fabulous, the three siblings. Mm-hmm. And just a minute, look how close you even sit while we're sitting here, right? Talk about a brother and sister. Yeah. Did you all do anything ahead of time? Because I'm assuming you all didn't know each other before you got here. How did you build the family relationships?
Before we got to Chicago, because we're the family, the four of us are all from out of town. Bryce is living in L.A., and Molly, Jordan, and I are in New York City. But Bryce spent some time in New York, and I made sure to capitalize on that time and introduce myself, and we had some time. We hung out, and I also hung out with Molly ahead of time. And we were, you know, messaging, and we were bonding, but really the last 7 weeks we've just sort of all fallen in love, mm-hmm. and we've tried to take as much advantage of any free time to be together. And
how much of Ned is you? Because I've seen you in so many things you do, there is this edge to you, this whatever, that I often see. How much of that is Wesley?
Well, I'm not an alcoholic.
Okay, that's okay.
But I read the play, mm-hmm. and I did feel like I was reading my part. I think it's just a sensibility. I mean, I have really resonated with all of Greenberg's plays in a way that I feel very akin to his, especially queer characters. It just feels very organic out of my mouth. Just, it's very natural. And I have, you know, I tend to play characters with a darker bite. And this just felt very tailor-made.
So to speak, says Wesley Taylor. And Greenberg always did have, I mean, there's a lesbian couple in this show. He always did reach out to other communities, and I think some would describe Greenberg's work as, many of the characters were sort of not far from who he was either, but he let them breathe.
Yes, he is, we've learned as we've gotten to know Richard through
friends
of his that have come through the room, or and Bob, who had been working with him, and he really...
Bob Falls, your director.
Yes, Bob Falls, our lovely director. Richard was such a beautiful playwright in that he put so much of his personal life into his plays. There's a moment in the show where someone that knew him very well, very, you know, deeply, came, and she was like, I told him that story that he wrote, and he put it in, and she just happened to be there that day. And so he really took so much of what was deeply personal to him and infused it with his art, which is so beautiful.
What story was it? Mm-hmm.
Okay, so in Act Two, in the attic, when our lesbian characters, Susan and Linda, and Linda, they're recounting something that happened in Red Hook, and it was like a
Red Hook prom.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and they're naming specific kids who were involved, and those kids' names
and the ran councilman
Apollo, Liev, and Charlie.
Who did the big finale of Dirty Dancing Leap. That happened.
And this woman in rehearsal was like, this happened, and I know those
video
kids.
Of
and
that moment
she showed us the
phone.
Video of what,
like,
we describe
I
in the play.
I said that to Richard. I told him that story.
And she said, you know, when he was alive, we all of his besties had to be very careful about what we said around him, because it would end up in his play.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, Julia's saying the line.
Exactly.
Yes.
We need to take a break.
Sure.
And so, and while we're going to a break and enjoying this set, you see, because we're on an official set, I'm just going to show these. We're not supposed to wear our real shoes, which is why Wesley can be comfortable, because he just got to. We're all doing our comfortable thing. So we're going to get comfortable for a few minutes, but we will be back with more Behind the Curtain and the story of Holiday, playing at the Goodman Theater through March 8th in just a minute. Stay with us. And we are back to Paul Lisnick Behind the Curtain. I'm sitting with two of the fantastic stars from Holiday, playing at the Goodman Theater only through March 8th. You can get tickets at goodmantheater.org, theater spelled the proper British way, T-R-E, which I think is the only way we should spell it.
Come on.
And so, as I'm talking to Wesley and Bryce, let me ask you a little about, I guess I need to come to you, Bryce, because this is all about a guy named Johnny Case in terms of the love relationship. We've talked around him. Who is Johnny Case? He's played in the show by Luigi Sottile. But even he undergoes a transformation over the course of this play.
Yeah, so Johnny Case is a young, up-and-coming lawyer in New York City who, unlike our family, has come from nothing and has sort of clawed and worked his way up to this position. And, you know, takes a, or he's gifted a vacation, a retreat almost, you know, by the characters in the place of Susan and Nika. And he, that is where he meets the Julia character. And it's sort of described that it's this absolute, like, off-grid type of a spa retreat. And
take so the
they away. Take their phones away and they're in, like, these, the desert. You know, we had a place that in rehearsal that we finally discovered where we think it's this kind of a spa, you know, in, in like the mesas of Arizona. And so Johnny Case, he's just this man who has spent his whole life working, and climbing to the top. And then when once he kind of gets there, he realizes that it's not actually what he wants to do, and it's not how he wants to spend the next 30, 40 years of his life, that he doesn't actually want to spend that time just piling up money and for nothing in some ways. And so it kind of becomes about his character discovering that about himself as he sees the family and sees, quite frankly, the unhappiness, and that money can't buy you everything, and that money does make the world go round, but that the heart has other needs. And so Linda, my character, and Johnny meet at this sort of just really beautiful time in their lives where they're both sort of feeling like we don't know exactly what it is we want to do, but it's just not this. And I think there's something really magical in the play, because we all have those moments in life where, you know, whether it wants to be love at first sight, I don't think that that's quite true. I think it's that, like, there's something about each other's soul that they just sort of, there's a spark there. And it's more so that they're attracted to each other's minds. Whereas for Julia and Johnny, it's a physical connection. It's an instant physical connection. And I think for Linda and Johnny, it's an instant soul connection.
And Ned, of course, watches all of this. And he's just processing this stuff. The Greek chorus, yeah.
I mean, the play really is a meditation on capitalism as well. And not to be cliche, but it is a question of working to live or living to work and sort of meditating on that idea the whole play.
Yeah. And Greenberg always used to write to sort of upper class, snobby kinds of characters, so they show up here. Wesley, let me ask you, the impact of Bob Falls. Look, he's a legendary director in these towns. He actually, you know, although he retired as artistic director after 160 years here, but he fortunately comes back from time to time. How did he influence? Because apparently the comedy, the impact of the comedy of the play as it was originally done, he's shifted with that. He's played with it. Can you talk about his impact?
You know, Robert Falls is not known for comedy. He's known for dramas.
So
you know
Chekhov.
What I'm saying? Yes, correct. And Shakespeare's, I think, it's classics.
Which he and knows Chekhov is funny, but most people don't think of it that way, and that's why his Chekhov is so brilliant and revered, is because he does know what the humor is, but people just don't associate him with that.
But also, this play is not like Mel Brooks. Like, it's not broad, faster, funnier, louder, like, you know, kind of comedy. This is much more creeping. I mean, it's a dramedy. It really is. It's a very much a quintessential Richard Greenberg play, which is very funny, but it also, like, surprises you with some real heart and pathos and heaviness. And I think Bob's, like, the perfect match for this play.
And he was a dream to work with.
He really was.
Is there any particular scene, Bryce, that you guys did that was especially difficult emotionally or technically? Or maybe something you would do that the audience might miss just because we're but you guys get it? Because the sibling relationship is so strong to me.
Absolutely. I mean, there's so many that I could talk about. I mean, personally, I find Act 1, just in general, so hard because it's so fast and Linda's so buttoned up. But I think, to get specific, we really toyed around a lot with our scene in Act 2 up in the playroom when he's describing to me what it's like to be drunk. And we felt, though, for the longest time, like we couldn't figure out what it was. And Bob was very open about being like, you know, I'm not quite sure what it is either. And that's why he is such a wonderful director to work with, because as actors, it can feel sort of, you want to pretend like you have it all figured out, and it can be kind of humiliating to say, I don't know what this means, or I don't know how to do this. And Bob would be right there with you. He would never make you feel stupid and that he had it all figured out and gosh, you're dumb for not knowing.
Yeah.
He
would say, be honest with him.
Yeah, he would say, I don't either. And it wasn't until we got an audience that we actually realized that it's sort of there's a humor to that scene that Richard so clearly wrote in there. It's just we couldn't see it. And so we like toyed with that one a lot and did it a lot of different ways. And it truly wasn't until we got an audience in that I think we kind of cracked into it.
And also just the reality of like working on comedy scenes where, you know, everyone in the room has heard everything five, six, no one's laughing at anything in the room. Right? And you forget that, oh, this is actually very funny, you know? And you're like trying to mine it, and you have so much self-doubt about like, what's not working about this? And then you put
Your character's so physical. When the audience shows up, did you say, ooh, I've got some freedom here?
Yes. I mean, Greenberg has written in such a pace, as such a score to this play. It's a music. There's a musicality to it. But the audience brings another musicality to the play, and you have to listen to them. Like, they inform the new rhythms of what it is. And it's not going to be the same every night.
But no, it isn't.
But you have to listen. You have to be attuned to what they want, because it informs the pause here or let's quickly get through this part.
So here's an inside the actor's studio kind of question. I'd like both of you to answer it. Bryce, I'll start with you. If you, Bryce, went to your character and could offer advice about how she should handle all of this, what would Bryce's advice be?
Oh, God. I would encourage her to be a bit more brave. You know, it takes Linda, for all the bravado that she sort of exudes, a lot of it's false, a lot of it's fake, or sort of put upon, and that ultimately it's not until she has this person in Ned, her brother, who she cares so deeply for, but has also been using Ned. Linda absolutely has been using Ned and Ned's illness and addiction and whatever as a means, as codependency and as a way to feel better about herself and things that like, and it isn't until Ned is the one that has a spine and says, you know, like, stop using me as an excuse. Let me go in this way and live life for yourself and on your own terms. And so I wish that I could give Linda the sort of freedom to find that a little bit more on her own. But it really is, Ned who does it, who helps.
And Ned can come at this in so many different places. Wesley, what would you advise Ned?
I could give him advice all day long. He's not going to take it. He's not going to take my advice.
Yeah.
I mean,
move in with me. Come on now. Of course.
Although, you know, Richard Philip Barry set Holiday right before the Great Depression, but Greenberg, you know, this is right before the pandemic.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the audience can enjoy it, but the characters don't know what's about to happen to all of their lives, and it might get pretty bleak for Ned.
It's true.
So, knowing what Wesley knows about what's about to happen, I was like, go with your sister.
Yeah.
You know, it's so much fear. I mean, he copes with humor and confidence, but he's terrified of being out on his own. And he knows he's consumed by this drug and this drink, and he doesn't trust that he can be on his own.
The fact that you know that he wouldn't listen to you.
Yeah.
We will agree that Chicago audiences are sophisticated and they get it. What do you want us thinking when we leave?
I don't want the audience to think one thing. I don't want them to leave thinking, oh, like, Linda, she's got it all figured out, and that Julia, she doesn't, and that Ned, he doesn't. You know, I want a Chicago audience to be able to have a conversation with their partner, with their friends, about the ideas of the play in general, of, you know, working to live, living to work. Because, you know, in some ways, like, Julia is neither right or wrong. She is making her own choices and becoming a mogul in her own sort of line. It's not like she's just, like, doing exactly what her father wants her to do or anything like that. And so I hope it facilitates conversation about life-work balance, because, you know, during the pandemic especially, I think a lot of people took stock of that, of like, well, gosh, you know, maybe I shouldn't miss that wedding, or maybe I shouldn't, maybe I should take that trip, you know.
But you can't reference because you don't know what's coming.
Exactly, right. It's true. So Wesley, I hope that people have just very rich conversations about that.
Wesley, what do you want us thinking on the way out? Besides, it was fabulous and standing ovation.
Tax the rich. No, I mean, I think, you know, certainly a few lines really resonate in terms of how much is enough. And, you know, when you're in a certain tax bracket, it's like, it is a game. And it is about winning a game. And it goes beyond the numbers and what you actually need and what's actually important. So I think people meditating on what's actually important, and in terms of their own wealth game, I don't know, that's what I would hope they would think about. Yeah. But she said it so beautifully. There is no right and wrong in this. There's no villains in this play. If we're doing our job right, you know, a lot of people, yes, she's the protagonist and I'm sort of... like, the two of us are sort of the heart, and you're supposed to be rooting for Linda and Ned, I suppose. But, like, I think a lot of what Julia says makes a lot of sense.
Oh, God, yeah.
And I think a lot of what Edward says makes sense and is reasonable.
And the only way to catch that, we're out of time because the show has to end, but can you guys hang on for just a couple of minutes when we're done for a little bonus chat, which will go to the podcast on Monday morning at WGNradio.com and everywhere else. So if you've enjoyed this, go watch the podcast because you're about to get just a little bit more from these guys. But for now, please see Holiday at the Goodman Theater. You have until March 8th to see it, and tickets are at goodmantheater.org. Thanks for watching us. I'm Paul Lisnick. We'll see you next week on Behind the Curtain. Bye-bye. We are back to Behind the Curtain with a little bonus chat, which thank you for just staying on to do this, Bryce Gangle and Wesley Taylor. We've been talking about Holiday, it plays through March 8th, but what I wanted to ask you about, we didn't have time, which is both of you, this is your first time at the Goodman.
Yes.
Now, there's lots of theaters in town. Look, you've done Broadway in Chicago. You've done Broadway. You've both been everywhere, but there's something to be, I hear from actors, there's something special about actually appearing at the Goodman Theater. Mm. And I know the Goodman's happy that I'm asking this question. I'll start with you, actually, Wesley. What is important about that you came in for this theater? A man who's done Broadway.
Yeah, but Steppenwolf, Goodman, these are theaters that every actor dreams of working at. I mean, it doesn't matter if you've been on Broadway. You want to work at the Goodman. I mean, it's just a dream venue. Well, it's got a reputation. And it's 100 years. I've seen plays here. I've come in. I flew in to see Nathan do Icewind Cometh. Nathan Lane, Brian Dennehy. Yeah. Directed by Robert Falls. And you know, when I was here doing The Addams Family in 1947, across the street at the Nederlander, formerly the Oriental, where we did it, I would look around at the theaters in Chicago and just dream of one day working at these theaters. I mean, it's such a rite of passage, I think, for an actor worth their salt. To work at these great regional houses that are so renowned.
And it's always amazing when people do come in and do that. So Megan Mullally's down the way, right? And all these people who want to be, it's really a treat for Chicago audiences. Well, you are here. I said in your intro, you've been at so many Chicago theaters, but not here.
Yeah.
So are you just going one more checked off?
Well, yeah. I mean, I spent so many years of my career in Chicago working at small storefront theaters. You know, I've done shows at Steep and Jackalope and you know, Red Twist and Rivendell. And so to be able to work in a house of this size was honestly a new experience for me. The Goodman, of course, as a young actor in Chicago and coming to Chicago to study theater in college, you know, it's just, it kind of feels like a bucket list place of where the work and the people that you're going to get to be surrounded with, it's really at a level that, yeah, I guess I just dreamed about as a kid. It's really a dream come true. And it's getting to work with someone like Robert Falls on a new play, you know. In Chicago, I've gotten the opportunity to work on so many new plays here. And it's just, that's been such an important part of my career. And to do it here at the Goodman is
So as I do wrap up, then let me ask you, this might be a good question to bring up at the end, because you're going through this experience, you've been playing now for quite a while, through March 8th. I'm curious, before you started, here you are now, have your views of privilege, money, have they transformed at all over the course of doing this play?
God, I mean, I love the line that Julia, Molly Griggs, incredible actress Molly Griggs, says about, she's talking about Linda, and she says, you know, what is more privileged about being sad, about being privileged? And that line consistently, and the way that she delivers it is so good, because consistently the audience has a reaction to it of like a, and you can sort of hear the wheels turning in the audience's heads of, you know, really taking that in and thinking about what it means. And, you know, there's something to that. And so I think about it from Linda's perspective, and how Linda does it from my perspective, you know, perhaps use others' positions or lot in life to maybe feel better about the guilt that she feels about her own life. And I don't think that's good. And so, you know, finding a middle ground of how to be of service in the world is what Linda truly wants. And I think hopefully can find that at the end of this play. But yeah, I think I look at how can one be of service, and whether that means financially or otherwise, you know, to be determined. But yeah.
And Wesley, same question, but I'm going to put a twist to it.
Okay.
Because you have to evaluate this question of your views of privilege and money and all that. But you're doing it from playing Ned.
Yeah.
And so sometimes I looked at Ned as somebody who has the issues and has the alcoholism and all that. But one day, he's going to be very rich, because this stuff is...
If he's still alive.
So you could maybe make that part of your answer. But the bottom line is, you're in the family of wealth. There's inheritance coming. So yeah, as Wesley...
Yeah.
How has that in that role affected you?
I don't know. I mean, it's like I have been thinking a lot more about what if I had this wealth? What if I, you know, there is one character in the play that Christiana Clarke plays, Nika Washburn, who is like the one character perhaps that the audience can look to as like, oh, a wealthy person who is using it for good, who is doing the right thing, like the good version of a very wealthy person, and how she resources and you know, raises money philanthropically and all of that. But I don't... Would I be that person? Or would I be more selfish? I mean, the ethical implications of... I don't know. I mean, I think about it a lot, yeah. And I think you're right. Ned could come into quite a fortune if he is still alive by the time that happens.
Okay. That's in your mind when you portray this.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Maybe that's what we get. Ned is he's funny, he's hysterical, but there's this aspect of maybe sadness to him, because he has this understanding that he's not sharing.
Well, he's also, we have the ghost of our mother, too, who died from cancer, but perhaps wouldn't have died as quickly from that cancer if her...
And you have that guy above me looking down, too.
Correct.
Yeah, which is funny, you know, like a little treat, since we're in the bonus portion of this, is that Richard Greenberg writes a ton of stage directions in his scripts, and they are in all caps, which none of us have ever seen a script written the way that Richard writes his scripts.
Does that mean do it?
Oh, it means do it.
It means like don't skip past this. I want you to see this.
You know, the beginning of the play opens, and he very specifically sets up a scene of like, you see this room, and it is empty, and it is dark, except for this portrait of this man, and this man doesn't like us very much. I mean, it's all so written. That is exactly verbatim.
Disapproving.
He disapproves, you know, and so...
Which means whoever painted that has to capture
that's
that
right.
in the look.
That's, right. That's not the first... That wasn't the first one.
Yeah, we had a different Edward Seaton, the first for...
Didn't make the cut.
And did Bob say that's not
working?
Make
the cut.
That's right.
Yeah, it wasn't correct. And so Walt got a new painting. Our fabulous scenic designer, Walt Spangler, got a new painting.
And by the way, when you came onto this set, there's also another set that we get in Act 2, which is just as phenomenal. And how they turned this into that is stunning. But did that strike... When you first walked on this set, did you kind of go, oh my God?
It changed everything.
Yeah, I mean, we knew what the sets were. I mean, we saw the designs in rehearsal, and we sort of saw the little models, and we knew what we were going to be... looking at, but when you're inhabiting the set, it's just a totally different experience.
This set in particular, like, it threw me off so hard for the first 2 days that we were working through our tech process, and I, to the point where I was like, I don't, am I ever going to get it back? Like, it really, the austerity of it, and I felt as Linda, I was like, I knew that Linda would feel not at home or not as comfortable here in this space, and man, I really felt that the first couple of times, and then trying to figuring out what that means physically and everything. But yeah, now I've really come to love this couch. We all love this couch. Yeah. We all like.
Do we ever come in? If I came in early, would I find you sleeping across it?
Gosh, maybe we should.
I mean, I use the furniture a little bit more comfortably, perhaps, just because I live here full time, and I'm sort of climbing on furniture in ways that it clearly is someone who.
And as Ned is observing, and Ned just has this observation thing going on, where it's just
he's always around the corner.
There's like a meta level to you.
That's
there's this
right.
meta
watching.
Level.
That's as you're watching, lurking, listening.
Lurking.
I love it. Thank you so much for this time. You've been very generous
thank
with
you
your time, and
you.
I sure appreciate so that. And thank you once again for watching Behind the Curtain. Remember, you got till March 8th, goodmantheater.org. Can you tell you don't want to miss this show? See you next time. Bye-bye.